Reporters Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today, 7th of May. Today, we will continue listening to Tenzin's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello and welcome to the program. One of the most important basic practices in Buddhism is mindfulness. In fact, we could say that from the beginning, it is the most important factor in training the mind. Mindfulness is the constant intelligent awareness of what is going on at any instant of time, with as little of our usual reactive conditioning as possible kicking in. Mindfulness, says the great Vietnamese master Thich Nhat Hanh in his book Peace is Every Breath, is the energy that makes us fully present, fully alive in the here and the now. Mindfulness is what brings us back in touch with what is happening in the present, in our body, in our feelings, in our thinking, and also in our environment. Mindfulness and concentration, he says, are the core energies of spiritual practice. Thich Nhat Hanh uses mindfulness to reach for peace and joy in the everyday moment, even at times of tension and stress. Wherever you are, he says, just be aware of what is happening within you, whatever state of relaxation, tension or pain, or even all of them at once in different areas, is there, just be aware. Don't fight the tension or pain, just look at it with bare awareness. Then you can breathe in, saying, breathing in, I'm aware of some pain or tension in my body. Breathing out, I allow the tension and the pain in my body to release. As your mind doesn't fight the discomfort, but releases it with a soft, compassionate attitude, the pain or tension will not seem such an enemy, and your suffering will be much less than if you worried about or fought the discomfort. Then, on top of mindfulness, we need to practice alertness, the faculty that lets us know when we've lost mindfulness. For instance, I'm taking a stroll in a park and start daydreaming about what I'm going to have for lunch. I might walk for several minutes going through the menu in my mind and lose all sense of what is going on around or within me. For those minutes, I have flown off into a phantom lunchtime world in my mind and have missed the vivid experience of actual living. I've lost mindfulness, and bringing the mind back to the present, or better still, not allowing it to go wandering off, is the function of alertness. The more alert we are, the less easy it is for the mind to do its usual thing of losing our present experience and jumping uncontrollably into the past, the future, or some alluring fantasy. In Tibetan Buddhism, mindfulness and alertness are not used so much to appreciate one's present experience as to nurture awareness of what to practice and what to abandon in life. And so in the text we are currently following, Shanti Davis' A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Chapter 5, the chapter we glanced at very briefly at the end of our last program, deals with guarding alertness. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says in his commentary to this chapter, we have to know why guiding alertness is important. He says that knowing what to practice and what to discard, we practice mindfulness to ensure the mind is always bound to the practices. Then, when mindfulness is powerful, introspection will see if the mind is really training in the practices and discarding those things that must be discarded. With alertness, these two mental factors of mindfulness and introspection will gain power. Without alertness, we might know what to practice and what to discard, but we will tend not to use mindfulness and introspection. And so, even though we have knowledge, we will still find ourselves doing actions that we should be avoiding and not concentrating on what we should be doing. Pema Chodron, in her commentary, No Time to Lose, labels this chapter vigilance and says it is actually about subduing the mind. She sees this chapter as about being mindful of our discipline, in line with what I said earlier about the Tibetans' view of mindfulness and alertness being about knowing what to practice and what to abandon. The theme of discipline, she says, generally emphasizes conduct, the way we speak and act. The main theme here, however, is taming the mind. In order for any outer discipline to transform us and for bodhicitta not to diminish, it is essential to tame the wildness of our minds. Now, for those of you who are new to the program, bodhicitta is the mind that is determined to attain enlightenment, or one's highest potential, to be the greatest benefit to all living beings, even up to guiding them to enlightenment. Shantideva's text, as I've said in previous programs, is a manual on how to develop, maintain, and increase bodhicitta. So in line with that, let's take a moment now, as we usually do, to set our motivation for participating in the program today. Let's make that motivation bodhicitta, the intention to attain enlightenment so that we can be the greatest benefit to all beings. Thank you. Now back to chapter 5, which opens with a verse, those who wish to guard their practice should very attentively guard their minds, for those who do not guard their minds will be unable to guard their practice. The practice that we are wishing to guard in the first line of this verse refers to the three trainings in morality, concentration, and wisdom. For a bodhisattva, His Holiness says, training of the mind is most important. In the training in morality, we concentrate on refraining from physical and verbal negativities. But for one who has taken the bodhisattva vow, it is more important to stop the mental negativities. That doesn't, of course, mean that those on the bodhisattva path can just do and say anything they want to, hiding behind the excuse that they are, in the meantime, keeping their minds pure. Now, I know that we discussed Pema Chodron's gloss on this verse in our last program, but just to remind us of what was said, I would like to read what she says again, because it's so very important. When the mind is wild, we have no foundation for maintaining discipline, she says, specifically the three disciplines of not causing harm, gathering virtue, and benefiting others. How can we work with the afflictive emotions, or act and speak with kindness, or reach out to others if our mind is crazed? Without the stability and alertness of attained mind, how can we be present? Therefore, mindfully, gently, and repeatedly, we train in coming back. She goes on to say, taming the mind takes time. Through good and bad moods, through periods of peacefulness and klesha attacks, we train in being present. Day by day, month by month, year by year, we become better able to keep a rule of life, better able to hear the cries of the world and extend a hand. For Pema Chodron, as I said last time, taming the mind means shamatha meditation, the practice of bringing the mind back again and again to the object of meditation. Like the common practice of focusing on the breath that Thich Nhat Hanh is so fond of. I like the way that both Pema Chodron and Thich Nhat Hanh emphasize the gentle persistence of the practice. Shantideva is somewhat more strident in his approach. He likes to use fear as a spur, as you've probably noticed, if you've been following these programs over the weeks. But for me, and I think for many Westerners, the practice of attentiveness with a gentle investigative intent is more inspiring and beneficial. Then we don't fall into the trap of punishing ourselves, as so many beginners in the West do. Often when starting to meditate, Westerners set themselves a sitting time of half an hour or more, even though they quickly start feeling uncomfortable. Now, this is not a good way to start a practice. For a beginner, it's much better to sit for 5 minutes and get up feeling happy than to try and sit for 30 minutes only to leave the meditation seat feeling tight and edgy. If you get up feeling uncomfortable, it is likely that the next time you come to meditate, your mind will be fighting you even before you put your bottom on the meditation seat. And it's also important in this kind of meditation not to judge or comment on what is happening. If we get angry with ourselves because the mind just will not stay in one place like we want it to, we are surely defeating the purpose of the practice. In our daily life, we're continually judging and creating attitudes to what is happening. But that is the very process that allows the emotions that cause us so much trouble to arise and to do their dirty work. If you get irritated with your mind's wildness during your meditation, aren't you just giving in to the afflictive emotion of anger once again? That is why Pema Chodron emphasizes that the practice is gentle and non-judgmental. So we don't expect anything from the meditation. We just accept the mind as it is at the time, do our best, and work with what we're given. As we become familiar with this process in our meditation, so we can carry it over into our daily life, becoming less judgmental, more forgiving, and somewhat more easy to live with. The key to maintaining alertness and vigilance is not to be harsh with ourselves. When we see the mind about to do something that we know will bring difficulties, we don't need to be like crabby old scolds. Just gently bring the mind back into the present and settle back into vigilance and alertness. As Pema Chodron says, this is a long, slow process, so proceeding gently but firmly will help us far more than being like a sergeant major over ourselves. And here, Shantideva has a point when he says in the next verse of his text, "In this world, unsubdued and crazed elephants are incapable of causing such harms as the miseries of the deepest hell, which can be caused by the unleashed elephant of the mind. But if the elephant of my mind is firmly bound on all sides by the rope of mindfulness, all fears will cease to exist, and all virtues will come into my hand." In line with his Indian background, Shantideva uses the analogy of a rogue elephant for the mind. The elephant being the largest of animals, it has the potential to cause the greatest amount of devastation when it does go rogue. Similarly, the untethered mind very easily lays waste our internal world with its projections, conceptions, and emotions. It tramples on any wisdom and reasonableness we might have and causes us immense suffering. However, as the well-tethered elephant will quietly do whatever its trainer wants it to do, the mind that is under control will always be intent on creating activities and will have very little reason for fear. And so His Holiness the Dalai Lama says that if we develop mindfulness, all fears will naturally cease. But if we neglect mindfulness, the mind will be like that wild elephant, and we will naturally express any negativities of body and speech whose intention pops up in our mind. Pema Chodron says that if she were to deliver the first of these two verses, she would say, "If our minds remain untamed and distracted, we will have constant emotional upheavals, and our anger and addictions will get stronger." And she comments that when Shantideva talks about the miseries of deepest hell, it's a synonym for the dire consequences of a distracted mind. "Until we start taming the mind," she says, "we're constantly pushed around by our emotions. Nothing in this world, no beasts, muggers, or outer threats, causes as much unhappiness as our own wild elephant mind." Mindfulness is what always brings us back to what we're doing, what we're experiencing in the present. Both Pema Chodron and Thich Nhat Hanh use the mundane example of brushing one's teeth. "You brush, you get distracted, you come back," Pema Chodron writes. "No big deal." And so it goes with mindfulness training. Mind is present, mind wanders, and mind comes back. By gently returning to the present, the mind calms down and everything becomes workable. Thich Nhat Hanh presents it as a challenge. "You're going to spend 1 or 2 minutes brushing your teeth," he says. "How can you do it so that you really have happiness throughout that brief couple of minutes?" "Don't rush. Don't try to brush your teeth as quickly as possible and be done with it. Focus all your attention on your brushing. You have the time to brush your teeth. You have a toothbrush, toothbrace, toothpaste, and teeth to brush. I'm 84 years old, and every time I brush my teeth, I always feel happy. You know, at my age, still having all these teeth to brush is a wonderful thing. So the challenge is to brush your teeth in such a way that you have that ease and happiness during the whole 1 or 2 minutes of brushing. If you can do that, you've succeeded. You're meditating right there. Here's a poem you can enjoy while brushing your teeth. Brushing my teeth and rinsing my mouth, I vow to speak purely and lovingly. When my mouth is fragrant with right speech, a flower blossoms in the garden of my heart. The verses are meant to help us bring our awareness back to what's happening in the present moment. We don't get caught in reciting the lines. If we already have mindfulness and concentration, if we really know how to dwell peacefully in the present moment already, we may be just as happy not using them at all. Now, don't you think that's quite beautiful? There's nothing aggressive or even extrovert about it. The practice is just so simple and straightforward. As Pema Chodron says, no big deal. But it lays to rest all those worries about the future, regrets about the past, and alluring fantasies that the mind is so ready to fly away to. Pema Chodron warns, though, as I've mentioned earlier, that although it seems simple, this practice takes a lot of time and patience. Our mental habits, she says, are ancient. In other words, they've been around us for a very long time, and they will take some time to unravel. We need to do the work with patience, intelligence, and gentleness, qualities that will gradually increase until at last they will drop into our hands seemingly magically. When the mind is settled, Pema Chodron says, virtuous qualities come to us more naturally. We have fresh insights and more kindness, relaxation, and steadiness. Which is all very untroubled. But Shantideva continues with his customary ferocious imagery. Tigers, lions, elephants, bears, snakes, and all forms of enemies, the guardians of the hell worlds, evil spirits and cannibals, will all be bound by binding my mind alone, and will all be subdued by subduing my mind alone. The perfect teacher himself has shown that in this way all fears, as well as all boundless miseries, originate from the mind. Now, I can't say that my mind is at all tamed, but perhaps an analogy from my past will illustrate something of what is talked about here. I was raised in southern Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, where there are many very poisonous snakes. We lived on the edge of a small town called Fort Victoria, and across the road that ran in front of our house was all bush, where the three children and our family would sometimes go to play. We wanted to see snakes, but hardly ever came across them, probably because as soon as the snakes heard us coming, they would slink off into the undergrowth. But I clearly remember one time not thinking about snakes, but coming across a puff adder, a sometimes strikingly beautiful but quite lethal snake, on the path I was walking. I stopped and let the snake slide into the grass beside the path, but then it turned and started going parallel to the path in the direction I was walking. I walked slowly beside it for a little while, admiring the pattern on its back and feeling quite friendly to it. Eventually, it took a turn into the bush, and I went on my way. At no time did I feel threatened by the snake, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't threatened by me. So neither of us were at any time in any danger. In contrast, quite often, when people encountered snakes in the bush in Zimbabwe, they would make a fuss and call their friends who would come with sticks and stones to batter the snake to death. Finding a snake brought a sense of perilous sport. Of course, the snake would get agitated and so become increasingly dangerous, but almost always it would be killed. From a Buddhist point of view, all that turmoil and hate not only leads to a turbulent, unwholesome mind in the present, but also leads to intensely miserable experiences in the future. And it's so unnecessary. So, as Pema Chodron points out, Shantideva is saying something revolutionary here, that all fear and suffering disappear when we tame our minds. If our mind is under control, even if we come across ghosts or cannibals, we will stay undisturbed. When we are present and awake, Pema Chodron says, Emotions have a short lifespan, but when we are unconscious, they can last for years. And now I have to tell you another animal story just to prove that my mind is still very much untamed, and perhaps to give you a laugh. When I was staying in the monastery in South India, I had a couple of little run-down rooms, one literally a ruin, and slept under a mosquito net. One night, I woke to find a scrabbling down by my legs. Half asleep, I switched on the light to come face to face with a rat that had somehow crept under the mosquito net and onto my bed. I let out a startled yell, and the poor, terrified creature scuttled up the mosquito net, trying to find an escape. Quickly, I lifted the bottom of the net up, and the rat dove out and shot as quickly as it could from the room. And now that showed up an untamed mind, and perhaps proves that I was braver as a young boy than a fully ordained monk. Continuing with Shantideva, the text goes, "Who intentionally created all the weapons for those in hell? Who created the burning iron ground? And from where did all the women in hell ensue? The Mighty One has said that all such things are the workings of an evil mind. Hence, within the three world spheres, there's nothing to fear other than my mind." In his commentary on these and the previous two verses, His Holiness says that all the harm doers in this life and the next, including life and natural calamities, are the result of negative karma, which can in turn be traced to afflictive emotions. All those calamities and so on are then the result of an untamed state of mind. So if we can train and subdue our mind, all external dangers will be undermined. And if we can cultivate a strong sense of compassion and love, naturally external forces will find it very difficult to harm us. His Holiness says that the line, "the workings of an evil mind," refers to the afflictive emotions. The three world spheres refers to the formless realm, the form realm, and the desire realm. But I don't have time to go into those now. If you don't know what they are, Google the three realms in Buddhism, and you can read about them on the web. Now remember that Shantideva was teaching to monks, so that when he talks about hellish women, he is referring to objects of intense lust. We could just as easily say, "From where did all the men in hell ensue?" if men are the object of lust. One of the descriptions of a hellish experience in the Buddhist canon is of a person walking through a forest of trees with razor-sharp leaves. The person hears the voice of the object of his lust coming from the treetops and climbs a tree to reach her. But as he climbs, the leaves face downward and slash into his flesh, and when he reaches the top of the tree, the object of his lust turns into a ferocious demon that attacks him and tears him apart. This experience happens over and over again, and the person is unable, due to his or her karma, to resist. You could, as I say, equally apply the description to a woman as a man. Such suffering results from an out-of-control craving of an extremely lustful mind, says Pema Chodron. It starts as an ember, but quickly ignites into a full-blown hell of insatiable desire. Then Shantideva turns his attention away from the evils the mind can get up to and focuses on what it means to perfect the virtues. He shows that such perfection is also completely dependent on the mind. "If the perfection of generosity," he says, "were the alleviation of the world's poverty, then since beings are still starving now, in what manner did the previous Buddhas perfect it? The perfection of generosity is said to be the thought to give all beings everything, together with the fruit of such thought. Hence, it is simply a state of mind." It is said that the Buddhas and high bodhisattvas have perfected the quality of generosity. But that does not mean that they found a way to give all away so that the world is cured of its poverty. Today, 1 billion children live in poverty. That is half the world's children. So having perfected generosity cannot mean that the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas have eliminated poverty from the world. Shantideva explains that the perfection of generosity refers to the mind that is prepared to give everything away to others and the results of such an intention. As His Holiness says, the perfection of generosity is therefore a state of mind. This is also true of all the other perfections: morality, patience, enthusiasm, concentration, and wisdom. And for the next seven verses, Shantideva shows how activities based on ordinary qualities of mind become enlightened activities based on the perfections when the mind is tamed. Pema Chodron says that our actions either undercut our attachments or strengthen them, bring us into the present or distract us. Whenever an action takes us beyond self-absorption, it becomes a perfection. But that will only happen when we tame our mind. For instance, how often do you do a generous action without the least thought of reward for yourself? This means that even if the recipient of your generosity spits in your face and insults your whole family, you remain undisturbed. Most of the time, we get offended if we give someone a gift and they don't even say thank you. This just shows how far our minds are away from the perfection of generosity. Until we can give everything, even our bodies, away without the slightest thought for ourselves, we still have work to do on the perfection of generosity. With insatiable craving, says Pema Chodron, whether we are rich or poor, we will always find ourselves living in a world of never enough. And that is why the GDP, the gross domestic product of the 41 heavily indebted poor countries of 567 million people, is less than the wealth of the world's seven richest people combined. Nowhere has the killing of fish and other creatures been eradicated. For the attainment of merely the thought to forsake such things is explained as the perfection of moral discipline. In Shantideva's time, fish and other creatures were killed, as he says, but not to their vast extent as they are today. Therefore, as killing is a negativity, we can hardly say that if physical evidence is our criterion, the Buddhas have perfected morality. The perfection of morality is not the elimination of negativity, but the mind that has completely given up negativity. And so Pema Chodron says, referring to this verse 11, until we have decided never to harm others, how can beings find a place of permanent safety? To the degree that we refrain from hurting one another, to that degree the world is a kinder place. Without this clear intention, no conventional disciplined conduct, however ethical it seems, will ever free us from the unconscious actions of a self-centered mind. And His Holiness says much the same when he says ethics is refraining from all harmful actions, as well as giving up all thoughts for personal gain and interest. Thus it is, once again, a state of mind. And on that note, we've run out of time and must say goodbye for another week. Thank you for joining us today. And please take a moment to dedicate any positive potential from the program to attaining enlightenment for the benefit of not only yourself, but all others as well. I hope you'll join us again next week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering.